Costs are a good thing. You're an economist. Trump wrote, the United States is the largest oil producer in the world by far, so when oil prices go up, we make a lot of money. This contradicted what he said at the State of the Union, saying oil prices were lower than under President Biden, and he was very proud of that. 30 seconds, your response.
He may put money into the hands of a few oil companies which pay his bills, which are corrupt, which pay his campaigns, but he's going to impoverish Americans, and he's throwing the entire world into a profound economic crisis. And the world's going to remember, and it's going to know very soon, Israel and the United States have put the entire world into a profound economic crisis. Again, the first thing you know, anything Trump writes is a combination of ignorance, malevolence, and lies, including that statement, Amy.
Jeffrey Sachs, we want to thank you so much for being with us. World-renowned economics professor, director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, president of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network, has served as advisor to three UN secretaries general, now a Sustainable Development Solutions advocate under Secretary General Antonio Guterres. We'll link to your articles at democracynow.org. As we end this show, a very fond farewell to our video fellow, Safwat Nazal. You will forever be in our DNA, Democracy Now! Alum, and thank you for your creativity, your humor, and your intelligence. Tonight, I'm heading to Mexico City for two screenings of Steal the Story, Please! At the Ambulante Film Festival. Tonight, it's in Cineteca Nacional. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hi, this is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Good morning, Portland. You are listening to KBOO Portland both times. I'm Althea. I'm here with...
with Reed, once again in the studio.
In the Genius Box, we have a great show set up today. We have a very special guest. Cindy Cohn is the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the leading nonprofit defending privacy and free speech in the digital world. Her memoir is out this week. It's called Privacy's Defender, My 30-Year Fight Against Digital Surveillance. And Cindy will be speaking at Powell's this evening at 7 p.m. We're lucky enough to have her in the Genius Box this morning. Welcome to the show, Cindy.
Thank you so much.
Very excited to have you with us and to talk about this book of yours. We can jump. Are you ready to jump in, Reed?
Yeah, let's go. Let's go right into it. If that's okay with you, Cindy.
Absolutely.
So your book is part memoir, part legal drama. You know, we want to get into it here. but it's called Privacy's Defender. Maybe let's start there. When did you first get interested in privacy as an issue?
Well, I think, you know, in the book, I kind of try to trace where some of this comes from. I was, you know, a kid who didn't fit in very well in the little town in Iowa where I grew up. And I think I kind of developed this idea that, you know, you needed this kind of safe space to be a little different than the people around you. But I really got involved in the early 90s when I was approached by some early, you know, computer hackers, and I use hacker in the best sense of the word, to help free up a technology that we all need to have privacy and security online. It's called encryption technology. And that's really when I kind of, you know, started understanding why privacy was important and the way it serves to help protect the less powerful from the more powerful.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that was something interesting I found in this book is, you know, that it's sort of sticky to define privacy. And it's interesting to talk about how the conversation around privacy has evolved and that there's a couple different ways to define it. Do you want to talk about some of what those frameworks are?
Yeah, you know, I mean, sometimes people think of privacy and they think of like Harry Potter's invisibility cloak, right, that you throw over your head when you're going to do something that, you know, you might not want other people to see. And, you know, privacy can serve that purpose. But to me, I think about privacy as a check on power. It's a way that people without power can have a space to organize, get information, communicate, and plan in ways that more powerful people have more power over them, can't interrupt or stop or break. And I think about there's kind of circles, right? I mean, we work with domestic violence victims at EFF sometimes who need privacy in order to plan their escape from people who they literally live with. And you need privacy if you're going to figure out how to get out of those situations. And we work with, you know, women who find malware installed on their computer that lets their abusers track everything they say and do in order to keep control over them. And then you scale it all the way up to you against companies. You know, right now people are starting to really experience what we call price discrimination, where the company knows a lot more about you and uses that to decide how much you pay for things, try to maximize what you pay. That's something that hits a lot of people. It's starting to hit a lot of people, but it's long been the case for other government programs or other kinds of things. And now we're seeing, kind of at the Trump administration really wanting to violate people's privacy in order to identify who they're going to pick up in their sweeps, in order to identify the neighborhoods they're going to go to, in order to identify protesters and people engaging in their First Amendment rights to observe and track the police. Privacy helps in all of those situations because it gives you a space where you can't be watched by the people who have more power than you. And I think it's fundamental to a country that claims to be self-governing, right? We claim, we have a secret ballot in this country for this reason. Now, privacy is woven throughout the ways in which people get protection from more powerful forces. Sometimes it's hard to see. And if it just gets framed as, if I've got nothing to hide, I've got nothing to fear, I think we're missing the bigger societal importance of it.
Yeah, maybe we can go back to kind of the beginning of the book and kind of your beginning of your history with the EFF. And you mentioned encryption, and I know that first legal case where you're representing Daniel Bernstein obviously involved, this question of encryption and the question of how one's private information, how one's safety, I guess, on the internet was preserved through encryption. And this was challenged by the federal government, the basis of encryption as sort of like a national defense, sort of a question of national security. So are these two kind of big arguments going on? You know, from your side, this is a question of, what are preserving one's fundamental rights on this new platform like the internet? And from the federal government on turning this software, this code into something, conflating it with other things like weaponry,
the export restrictions was
and applying these wild export restrictions to it. So I guess Maybe you can talk about that initial battle and just the question of, you know, the debate over whether this is a question of national security or whether this is, you know, something about one's fundamental rights. Kind of go into that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I'm pretty critical of the government here, but you can kind of see where they're coming from, right? I mean, if you know your history, you know that being the Americans, the Allies' ability to break the German codes and the Japanese codes is one of the keys that people point to why, you know, we won World War II. So, and you go all the way back to Caesar, you know, Caesar had a cipher, right? Thomas Jefferson had a cipher, you know, he was in Paris and John Adams was in London and, you know, the other people who fomented the American Revolution were in, you know, the colonies, and they all had to communicate in secret. And Jefferson actually had a physical, you can see it, a physical cipher that they used. So it's not crazy that the military thought of software with the capability of maintaining secrecy as a thing that should be on the list with surface-to-air missiles and tanks and other things that you can't export from the United States. But it just became clear in the early days of the internet that the rest of us were going to need access to this technology. It was going to be needed to be built into the internet at a basic level if we were going to have any privacy or any security. The interesting thing about encryption is the thing that gives you kind of personal privacy is also the thing that keeps you secure. And you know, makes it so bad guys can't get access to your stuff. It's not just about the government, and it makes the internet reliable. I mean, the internet has a long way to go to be really secure, but without encryption, you know, you would type in the URL for your bank and somebody could be hijacking it and you could be a whole other place and have no indication, right? There's a lot of kind of under the hood encryption in addition to things like Signal that a lot of people are using to organize right now that are possible because we freed up encryption. So some of the people who founded EFF kind of recognized that this technology was going to be very important and that we had to get the export regulations out of the way. And they approached me and asked me if I would put together a lawsuit to challenge those regulations. And the other piece of this is that encryption, you know, I'm talk about it in defense and other things, but it's also a science. It is a scientific discipline that, you know, works the way the scientific method works for everything else, which is somebody says, I have an idea, let's try this. And somebody else goes, no, I tried that idea and here's all the ways it doesn't work. And maybe we need to do this, right? This thing that, you know, I think most of us learned in grade school about how science progresses was even in the 90s happening on the internet. So my client was a math PhD student here at UC Berkeley, and he wanted to publish a computer program on the internet. And because of the way these export restrictions worked, he had to get a license as an arms dealer in order to publish this little computer program called Snuffle. So we challenged that on the grounds of the First Amendment, that you know, anytime you have to ask the government for a license before you can speak or publish something, that's a very... that requires a very high level of carefulness for the court to take a look at whether it's okay. So we used this prior restraint doctrine and we challenged the export regulations, and this kind of ragtag team of lawyers and hackers, we were successful. We were able to get first the district court and then the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to agree with us that these regulations didn't violate the First Amendment. And as a result of that and a lot of other pressure, the government ultimately backed down, and that's why we all have encryption in, you know, to the extent that we have it today. So it was kind of a crazy, you know, thing. And it really, to me, you know, today where a lot of people are feeling powerless and they're feeling like the game is rigged, there's nothing we can do to stand up against it. To me, I thought it was important to tell this story because we were nobodies. And, you know, I mean, I'm a fine lawyer, don't get me wrong. I have, but like, you know, I was a couple years out of law school. You know, there were many people who were more storied in the profession who kind of thought we were a little crazy sideshow, especially going up against the national security infrastructure. But we were able to prevail. And again, we didn't do it by ourselves, but it's a story about how no matter where you are, and those hackers, they showed up at every hearing. You know, they did public things like, you know, people put encryption code on T-shirts and in books to demonstrate how the export restrictions weren't very good. I think one guy even got a tattoo. So by, you know, drawing attention to this very obscure, you know, most people weren't on the internet at the time, we were able to push back against the national security infrastructure and get something for everyone. And I felt like that was a tale that was worth retelling in this time?
I think definitely so. I mean, it was a narrative that I wasn't familiar with, and it's interesting to think about how much that is taken for granted now, that a lot of the utility of the internet as we know it today is entirely predicated on their being encryption, and that was something, you know, that people were like building for free at the time, and that the government was, you know, from this national security argument, trying to regulate. And the national security kind of blanket, no, you're not allowed to do that, is something that you've encountered a lot in the legal career with Electronic Frontier Foundation. Can you tell us about that? How do you counter a national security sort of blanket, don't ask me about that, you're not allowed?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it takes patience, right? And it takes being in it for the long run. But yeah, after, you know, the Bernstein fight, that was the name of that case in the 90s for crypto, you know, was mostly in the 90s. And of course, September 11th happened. And, you know, as a result of that horrible tragedy, the national security forces in the United States and the domestic security forces, the FBI, you know, rushed to put into place a bunch of things on the theory that our privacy was the problem. Now, you know, a couple of years later, the 9/11 Commission came out and said that actually wasn't the problem at all. The problem was you didn't look at the very clear signs that you got, and you convinced yourself that something couldn't happen that then did. But by then, the law had been in place for a while. They rushed the Patriot Act into place, and they also started a bunch of secret programs that only came to light, you know, later. And, you know, unlike the Bernstein case, where we kind of had a clean narrative and a clean win, this is one where it's really been fits and starts. You know, we'll push on them, they'll push back, something will happen, and they'll be able to reclaim some ground that we claimed. And it's really been, you know, kind of a back and forth. But over time, we have chipped away on a lot of the things that the government did, and we brought a lot of light to a lot of other things. You know, there was a whistleblower who walked in, literally knocked on our front door in 2006 in San Francisco, and gave us the schematics for some of the NSA spying that was going on at a facility in downtown San Francisco. But he also had the plans. We saw all the West Coast, all up and down the West Coast, how they were doing this, tapping into the internet backbone. And, you know, our work in this inspired more whistleblowers to come through, which pushed the government to give more transparency and do, you know, some public reporting. We sued originally over three programs. By the time the case, you know, the Supreme Court let us down in this by the end, but by 17 years later, one of the three programs was gone altogether. The other one was dramatically scaled back. Both of the others were dramatically scaled back. And the third one, which is now called Section 702, is actually up for renewal in Congress in April. And we're going to be doing a lot of work between now and then to really try to push for even more reforms. I mean, I'd like the whole thing to go away, but some of these victories we have to make incrementally, and we've already scaled it back a lot. We're going to keep scaling it back. I talk about some of the national security stuff, like a house cat that got turned into a lion, and we're trying to shrink it back down to the size of a, you know, kind of a mean house cat to help protect people's privacy and help make sure that, you know, the balance between what, you know, law enforcement and the national security say they need to keep us safe and what we need to have our liberty, that we're continuing to make sure that we're not washed out of that debate.
Go ahead.
Yeah, maybe we could, just touching on like the Patriot Act, I think it's so fascinating to see in your memoir, in this book, to see the change, you know, your career kind of being marked by that point. You know, I know in the Bernstein case, you mentioned the you know, federal defense bringing up the question of the defense counsel, I should say, bringing up the question of national security. And you talk about the federal judge, I forget in which of the cases it was, but being rather unsympathetic or kind of not really buying the argument that well. Yeah. I wonder, how did that, you know, credibility of national security, maybe in, you know, court cases and then just beyond, how did that kind of change with the Patriot Act? How did you see it changing for you?
Yeah, it has become, and I blame administrations of both parties for this, it's really become, you know, kind of a I hate to say trump card in this time, but it's become something that really stops courts from being able to look at it, stops public oversight, stops even congressional oversight. And I think it's very problematic. It's no surprise that when you look at what the Trump administration is doing now, underneath so many things that they're doing, they're claiming national security. You know, that's because the table was set. And, it was set by Dick Cheney, who ultimately said, you know, he didn't like what was going on with the Trump administration. But he created, and David Addington and other people in the G.W. Bush administration, you know, created the kind of Swiss cheese of holes in our constitutional rights under the claim of national security that now we see the Trump administration really exploiting in all places. It's not, you know, it's just not a surprise to me. It's very sad. But, you know, this is an administration that looks for all the various places where they can push against our rights and increase their power vis-a-vis us as the public. And national security is ending up being one of the key ones that they're doing. So we really have to reset and try to get back to a place where just because you say national security doesn't mean that the courts have to sign out of the conversation, that Congress has to do real oversight. Like, and you know, when you uncover, when you go deep into some of these national security arguments, as we were able to do after September 11th, and many of the stories that they say about how these authorities kept us safe or stopped terrorist attacks, they fall apart. They're not. There have been less than 500 prosecutions, terrorism-related prosecutions, since in the first 10 years after September 11th, when things were really hot and heavy. They got communications records and information about hundreds of millions of people, right? At some point, the balance between our rights has to come back.
Mm-hmm. Folks, if you are just tuning in, this is Genius Box. Althea and Reed here. We're talking with Cindy Cohn from the Electronic Frontier Foundation about her new memoir. If you would like to call in, if you want to talk to Cindy, of course, major privacy online expert, what an opportunity. Our phone number is 503-231-8187. You can also message us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and join the conversation. One thing you mentioned earlier, Cindy, was that Section 702 is up for renewal and that's something that EFF is focusing on kind of going forward into the year. Can you tell us what that is and what that section does?
Yeah. So after September 11th, the government engaged in a massive program of spying on Americans at the facilities like the AT&T facility on Folsom Street in San Francisco that Mr. Klein brought us the evidence of. They were doing that completely off the books, you know, under just a presidential order. When it came to light, and honestly, some people inside the later administration said this isn't okay. Congress needs to sign off on something this massive that affects American people. It ended up getting into something called Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. And this is the law that purportedly authorizes some of the mass spying that goes on, with the idea that the government gets to sit on the junctures in key switching stations on our telecommunications infrastructure and get copies of everything that goes over those wires, and then sorts out second what they actually need according to some rules that were secret and are still pretty secret about what they do with the information once they get it. The one thing that Congress did do in the FISA Amendments Act is say, okay, well, we're going to authorize this for a few years, but it expires, and Congress has to come back and renew it periodically. This came up a couple of years ago. What Congress often does is just kick the can down the road. But the latest time it expires is in April this year. And EFF and a lot of other groups and organizations and things like Senator Wyden, your Oregon senator, who is a hero, a legit hero on this issue and many others, are trying to push back and trying to rein this program in. I think there are three or four different bills that are trying to rein it in different ways. And the national security forces really just want it to be permanent so they don't have to keep coming back to Congress and have any accountability. And the Trump administration has not been clear about where it sits on this. You know, Mr. Trump President Trump doesn't like the National Security Forces sometimes because they had a history of telling him no for a while. So it ends up with some strange bedfellows in terms of people who are nervous about the national security infrastructure. So we'll see how it plays out. But this is our opportunity as members of the public to make our voices heard and say we want this mass spying to stop. Again, you guys are in Oregon. You have a champion. Make sure he knows that you think he's doing the right thing. Sometimes I think he might feel a little lonely. So I would urge people to make sure that they let Senator Wyden know that they support what he's doing and your other representatives. We'll see. National security people are still very, very powerful in Congress. The fact that we were even able to scale things back at all felt a bit like a miracle in light of the Snowden revelations a few years ago. This is how some of this happened, and a little earlier is when 702 happened. But it was because of public awareness that they actually even passed the law to begin with and created some oversight. So we need Congress to continue to exercise its role.
Right. I'm curious about how, from your perspective, how has public attitudes about these sort of digital privacy issues, about companies and then the government and then the companies and the government working together to spy on people, how have you seen the public opinion evolve over time?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You know, we're in a time where I think it's increasingly clear to very many people how dangerous this is, how this way in which corporate surveillance of us feeds government surveillance, people, you know, being swept up, people being separated from their families, people, you know, protesters being followed home by, you know, by ICE agents, you know, to intimidate them. This is the end result of the kind of private and governmental spying being marshaled against us, and AI adds a whole other level of powerfulness to this. So I think more people are seeing it than ever before. I'm seeing a lot of political organizing happening over Signal that used to happen over, you know, much more insecure channels, because people are starting to wake up to the need for privacy and security. That's all good. I would say a few years ago, you know, there was a while where people would ask me, are you more worried about the company spying on you or the government spying on you? And I would have to say, you know, that's a fake choice. Like, nobody is giving you that choice. The number one purchaser of data broker information, that is this, you know, shady business model that collects information about us, is the government. That's where it comes from. They tapped into AT&T's phone networks to get access to these things. They've always gone through the companies and are used to riding along with corporate surveillance. So, you know, the bad news is we have to deal with both. We have to both have consumer privacy laws. We have to stop the surveillance business model. And we have to put protections in place for the government to have access of this information and limits on what they can do with it. So I think things are starting to change. I think the things that we fear, that we see a lot, is people feeling like, you know, the game is so rigged, they'll just give up and there's nothing you can do. I'm here to tell you there are things you can do. I mean, I'm not going to tell you it's easy. I've spent a lifetime doing this, but like, there's only two choices, right? We either lose now or we fight and we lose later. It's not like, you know, I mean, some people can opt out and go live in the woods, but I think a lot of people cannot. And we need to stand for them as well. So I've seen this shift, from, you know, in the 90s, where we were very worried about governments and totalitarianism, to people really thinking the government wasn't the problem and companies were the problem. And now I think people are beginning to see that these two things aren't really separate. And, you know, the good news is people are starting to see it. The bad news is it feels like we have two problems, not one.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. We have a caller with a question for you. We got Tawasi on the line. Hey, Tawasi.
Hey, good morning. I was hoping you could remind us about the failed Total Information Awareness Act. I noticed you're talking a little bit about some of the older things in our society, and since it feels like we live under the Total Information Awareness Act right now, I was hoping you could just remind us about what that is.
Oh, that's so great. That's such a great question. So one of the things that did not succeed after the Patriot Act was this thing called total information awareness. And this was championed by Admiral Poindexter Negroponte. But anyway, it was an attempt by the government to begin to marshal all the information that the government had about us in various different silos and use it. Including commercial information, but the focus of the early research was the government's information, into one interface that you could look at and get information about. So if you were law enforcement or other people. And this was roundly rejected by the American public when they tried to do it in public. And it became kind of the butt of a joke, right? They made this scary looking logo and everybody made fun of it. And it was rejected as an idea. But you're exactly right that they have rebuilt it. They just rebranded it, rebuilt versions of it. And now we have tools like Palantir that effectively do this. It doesn't have to be in one database, right? They build an interface in a way that they can query and look at multiple databases at the same time and have effectively the same power as if it was all in one. And we are really living in a time where, you know, not only are we living under the dream of or nightmare of total information awareness, although the technology works a little differently, the reality is the same. But now, again, with AI and some of the, you know, the way that the ability to marshal that evidence against people has gotten much, much better than it was in the 90s. So in some ways, it's the worst of what they wanted to do in the 90s with an added layer of more power than they.
One more thing, if you're still there, could you talk a little bit about fusion centers? We have a fusion center here in Oregon, and the way that those work in the electronic frontier.
Yeah, I mean, fusion centers are kind of the physical places where a lot of this happens. It's where local law enforcement or state law enforcement and federal law enforcement all have access to some of the same information. So that's the fusion. The fusion is, local law enforcement has information, state has information, and federal. And the feds can come in and get access to information that local law enforcement has. And these have been a bit under the radar, but they're tremendously important. They're kind of where this stuff happens. Some of them are actually physical buildings. It's actually where some of this stuff happens, where the information that your local law enforcement has gets made available to the feds.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your call, Tawasi. I think we're going to take a short musical break, and then we'll be back with Cindy Cohn from the Electronic Frontier. Excuse me.
Get it right.
Foundation. So we'll jump to the music and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Picture a bright blue ball just spinning free. Dizzy with eternity. Painted with the skin of sky, brushing some clouds. Call it home for you and me. A peaceful place, a sword looks from space. A closer look reveals the human race. Full of hope, full of grace is the human face. But afraid, we may lay our home to waste. There's a fear down here we can't. Just here, always awake, always around, singing ashes, ashes all fall down, ashes, ashes all fall down. Now watch as the ball revolves and the nighttime falls, and again the hunt begins, again the blood wind calls, by and by again the morning sun will rise, the darkness never goes. No! It strolls the sidewalks and it rolls the streets. Staking turf, dividing up meat. Nightmare, spook, piece of heat.
And we are back here on KBOO Community Radio. This is Genius Box. I'm Althea. I'm here with Reed.
Hello.
We have the distinct pleasure of talking with Cindy Cohn from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That's the leading nonprofit defending privacy, free speech, civil liberties online. Her memoir is out this week. We're talking about that and about her history with the organization. Also, Cindy will be speaking at Powell's this evening at 7 o'clock. Folks at home, if you would like to join the conversation, incredible opportunity to ask Cindy a question. We're having a lot of fun doing it. That phone number is 503-231-8187. You can also message us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. Click on that chat with us button and we'll get into it. Reed, where should we got lots to talk about with this memoir, a rich conversation of this issue. Where do we want to go next?
Well, I think we should maybe take a note from the musical interlude, and we can just kind of quickly, Cindy, I know you referenced the Grateful Dead in your book. I know there's a, you know, an important Grateful Dead sort of connection to
you
the
share
EFF.
That with a lot of our listeners, the affinity
and,
for the Grateful Dead.
And KBOO is, you know, informally basically a Grateful Dead channel with some
on
talk
Saturdays, rate. On Saturdays.
nice.
But can you maybe talk about your connection to the Grateful Dead? And just one thing that I took away was just your connection between the, you know, that, like, especially the community in the 90s of sharing bootleg tapes and, you know, kind of seeing the most, like, fruitful aspects of the internet and what the internet can offer in that community.
Yeah, you know, I was always a bit of a deadhead. I wouldn't call myself, you know, I never traveled or anything like that, but I think underneath the Dead, where everyone was welcome, including people who didn't fit in where they were from, and as somebody who didn't feel like they fit in where I was from, that it really felt an affinity to that. And then, you know, their approach to sharing music, right, which wasn't a proprietary closed approach, but really encouraged people to, you know, make tapes, pass things around, share it. The idea that, you know, our culture is ours. It's not owned, and we don't rent it by the hour. It's our culture. They really embodied that in the way they did it. And as a result, you know, they became a hugely successful band despite having almost no radio play until like the late 80s, right? So I thought that was cool too. And then I got, you know, tremendously lucky in that one of the three people who founded the Electronic Frontier Foundation was John Perry Barlow, who wrote Throwing Stones, the song you just played, but and several others. He calls himself the junior varsity lyricist for the Grateful Dead, you know, recognizing the amazing power of Robert Hunter, and also just being Barlow. But, you know, we ended up being pretty good friends because I started getting involved in this. And I think there was especially in the 90s, you know, the internet was a place that really welcomed people who didn't fit in too. And so it's not surprising to me that there was a lot of overlap between, you know, kind of that spirit of openness and sharing of ideas and knowledge and music, you know, in the Grateful Dead community, you know, some of the same people found that on the internet. And I think that there was an ethos there that that infused a lot of the early internet. Now, you know, I don't want to be starry-eyed about it. It was a very narrow set of people. It didn't have the diversity that it needed. As a woman on the early internet, I really felt the power of the male, white male domination of it as, you know, kind of, it was very attractive, but not to as wide a range of people who now really, really need the technology. But it's still helped me feel, I was an English major, I wasn't a technical person, and it helped me feel like I could belong in this community. And I think there is still some of that spirit left. I see it when I go, when I travel around, that there was a hope that we could fix some of the problems in the offline world, in the online world. I would say that hasn't ended up happening. And this is an area where Barlow and I often disagreed. He kind of liked to posit this vision as a separate world where we could start over. And I don't think he thought that literally in the way that some people will say he thought it literally. I know after talking to him that he thought, well, we can't build a better world. I'm going to just pretend like it's already there, and then that way people will have something to think about and a way to you know, like that you build a better world by pretending it already exists and then hoping everybody catches up. But that was never, that didn't end up happening, right? Instead, I think some of the worst parts of the online world, like we don't own things, we just license them, has now bled into the offline world. We've seen a lot of things that didn't go the way that I think a lot of us in the early days had hoped. But some things did. You know, we have instantaneous communication with people all around the world that is effectively free for people. We have the ability to have access to a lot of the world's information, far more than we had when I was a little kid in a small town in Iowa, you know, from a little device that we carry around with us. There are things that are revolutionary about that. We have basic privacy. We can have a secure communication with somebody around the world and plan and plot with them about a protest or other things that we might want to do, you know, in a way that is protected from, you know, people who might want to thwart us if we do it carefully and we do it right. And those things are only possible because of the way digital networks work. So there's more work. There's tons of work to be done, and there's new problems that have come up. But I think there is something about that spirit that, you know, it's important to remember because it, you know, sometimes we look at the internet and we think, oh, it's just a bunch of tech bros with, you know, dystopian ideas. And I'm not saying those guys weren't there. I'm just saying they were never the only people there.
It's a good clarification. Well, and I think what was so interesting for me reading your memoir and tracing the history of this push and pull and talking about these sort of fights that have happened in the past but are still sort of continuing today is just to see how, I don't know that younger generations are necessarily as tuned into that. And I think kind of to a point that you made earlier, there's a like a nihilism that you see online, an absurdism almost. There was a meme a few years ago about talking about like, what does my FBI agent see on my phone? Or like, oh, my FBI agent is going to be so worried about me because I'm listening to so much sad music. Or, I mean, that's sort of like a watered down version of it. Yeah. But part of what you say in the book is that you want to recruit people to this fight. How do you counter that nihilism, that sort of like acceptance, I think, in younger generations? Yeah, of course I'm being spied on. Yeah, whatever. That, you know, what the heck am I going to do about it? That's just the way it is.
Well, I think sadly, the world is making my case for me, because I think you can say, oh, I don't care, I've got nihilism. But when they start sweeping in your neighborhood and picking up your neighbors and exporting, you know, and throwing them into deportation camps, I think a lot of people who thought, well, there's nothing I can do, suddenly realize that not only were there things that they could do, that there were things that they must do. And building security into that is just I think becomes pretty obvious once you decide you have to do that. And especially, you know, it's horrifying but not surprising to me that the two people who were killed in Minneapolis were both exercising their First Amendment right to record and observe the police, the ICE and law enforcement. And, you know, so that means that we need to build secure ways for people to engage in this behavior if we're going to stand up and protect our neighbors, our families, ourselves. So in some ways, this was a harder argument to make before the Trump administration, because I was often talking about what could happen or what might happen. You know, Ed Snowden, when he wrote his book about it, he called it turnkey totalitarianism, right? This idea that in the future it would be very easy to have an authoritarian government if we were all being spied on all the time. I think now it's not hard to make that case to people, because it's actually happening around us in ways that we can see and feel, whereas a lot of it was hidden. I think the other piece of it is just to, you know, and kind of the reason I wrote the story as a first person narrative, and I talk a little bit about community and music and other things in it, is I think that it's important to not think that you're alone. And it's important to find ways to balance, you know, your kind of outrage and wanting to help with times that you rest and recharge. And that this is a team sport. And, you know, I joke at EFF sometimes that we have an outrage stick, you know, that we pass around, like the talking stick, where one person is like totally pissed off about something that's happened and they get to rage and be outraged about it. And the rest of us will support them. And then, you know, we get to pass the stick around, right? And I think thinking about this moment, not as something that we have to do all by ourselves or that we have to do all the time. And even people who are in much, I've had the luxury or the honor of working with people all around the world who have fought totalitarian governments and authoritarian governments in situations that are much more dire than here. But they will all talk to you about having a moment, a place where they can step back and rest. And sometimes that's just a place in their head where they can put down the outrage and let other people carry it for a while and then come back in. It's a relay race. And I think that thinking about who are your people and how do you and your people do this together, how do you do this like a team, is one way that we share the load, but also that we kind of keep inspiring each other.
Folks, we are talking with Sinead Cohen, the executive director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, not just electric, but we'd love to for you to join the conversation with us. Our phone number is 503-231-8187. Call in with your questions and your comments. I think that comment about finding community and in sort of like centering your experience of the internet is a really important piece of your book. And I found it just like your book is such a humanizing portrayal of the internet, which I will say doesn't always
feel very human.
feel very human or like a community. I think that's like one of the most, from someone who didn't grow up in the 90s, I was born in the 90s, but really didn't have much of my my formative years then. Your descriptions of, you know, like the hacking culture of this culture of, like, I would say empowerment. And obviously, you know, maybe that also came from the background of that community and being predominantly white and male, but like that sense of being able to take this newfound technology and mold it in a certain way. I think that's something that's absent for the average person, certainly not for, you know, corporations and for the government, but for the users of the internet. I think there's vanishingly few experiences that I feel when I'm not just a consumer of something else. Correct. or just kind of exposed in my online personality. I mean, can you talk about like what are the potentials for like online empowerment for those kinds of opportunities in the present day?
Yeah, I mean, look, the other piece of this that isn't really my focus of the book, but that happened at the same time is this, you know, corporate business model, the surveillance business model became the only business model for most of the major tech companies. I mean, Apple still sells you shiny discs, so I don't want to lump them all in together. But really, surveillance capitalism, which is what it was got called by a Harvard professor, I call it the surveillance business model, became the predominant one. And because of things that have kind of more to do with the way our society is structured right now and the lack of antitrust enforcement, you know, we ended up with five big companies that are, you know, I talk to people about the early internet, and I talk about something called Usenet news groups, which were this decentralized way that people organize things. And the best thing I can talk about is like, well, this is kind of like Reddit, except it wasn't owned by a company, right? This is kind of like Discord and little, you know, and except it wasn't owned by one big company. And that except part is really important, right? All of these things that used to be decentralized and kind of supported by communities are now companies with business models that can really change things. Now, not all companies are bad. I'm not anti-company, but I think that this surveillance business model has really warped everything. And and the early internet people thought this. I mean, there's early quotes from an organization called The Well, what was a place where some of the EFF founders met each other. It was an early online, it was a company for a while, an early online thing. But they said, we need to make sure that the internet remains a place of community and a town square and not just a shopping mall. Right. So that's a 1990s version of thinking about the difference between something that's kind of public and open and something that's closed and corporate. And I think that we have gone headlong into closed and corporate. And, you know, so there are growing communities of people who are trying to free us from this. You know, there's a whole decentralization movement, re-decentralizing the internet. And you see things like the Mastodon or other kind of more decentralized, less controlled ways for people to communicate. Even Blue Sky, which is owned by a company, you know, is building a protocol, a way for social media to talk to each other that isn't just controlled by one company. We work with a lot of people who are trying to do, kind of interoperable things, so, you know, a tool that helps you communicate with your people on Facebook without actually having to be on Facebook. And Facebook hates this and they sue those people, but we want the fight, right? Because I think it's, at this point, it's hard, especially for people of a certain age, maybe to switch. But you should be able to do it on your terms and have different terms than the one that they dictate. And that feels, you know, kind of, it shouldn't feel as crazy to people as it does. We all use email. Email is something that is a decentralized protocol. Like you could have, I can write you an email. It doesn't matter what company you're with or what company I'm with. They can all communicate. Why? Because it's not a corporate system. It's a protocol system. My friend Mike Masnick calls it, protocols, not platforms. So there are people who are starting to develop these things. They're too small. And this is one way where people who have tech skills, who are like, well, I'm not a lawyer. And, I'm an introvert. I like to, sit alone all the time. That's great. There's plenty of coding that you could do that would help support this. The Signal system was built by, on top of a protocol that already existed, but the actual interface that we all use was built, initially by just one guy. And now it's a thriving nonprofit. It's got a lot of things. It's still, I think, the gold standard for secure communications. But there's role for coders. There's role for marketing people. There is such a role for people who do user interfaces and make things easy to use for the rest of us. There's a lot of roles for people who, aren't necessarily lawyers or activists, for whom, going to a protest might not be the best way for them to use their skills. And so, part of what I'm trying to do in the book is open up the aperture about what people can do to make things better, to make sure that everybody feels like they can have a role for making the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. We have caller Tangent on the line. Hi, Tangent. You're on with us.
Hey. Peace to everyone. I was enjoying the last song. I've heard it lots of times. I never really listened to the words. Beautiful, beautiful. I'm thinking of another track from the Moody Blues. The first track... from On the Threshold of a Dream. Are you familiar with it?
Not what's personally. The track?
Okay, it's a monologue. I'll do it for you if you like. It's rather short, about a minute.
Oh. I don't know about all that, Tangent. We can look it up afterwards if that's your plug.
Okay, but it's all about the computer, but it was written like 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's rather prophetic. Yeah. It starts out, I think, therefore I am. I think. And then a voice comes in. Of course you are, my bright little star. You're miles and miles, brief miles from your forefather's fruit. And now to suit our great computer, your magnetic ink. I'm more than that. At least, I think I must be. There you go, man. Keep as cool as you can. Face piles of trials with smiles. It riles them to believe that you perceive the worldwide web they weave and keep on thinking free.
Yeah, I think that captures some of the early optimism of what... you know, what the internet could be. But the, you know, the tricky part about it is I think there were people who thought it was inevitable. And sometimes Barlow said this too. It was something I always bristled at a little bit. But it's not inevitable. You don't start an organization like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and hire like fighty lawyers like me because you think it's magically all going to be better. And I think that that's the message of the times we're living in now. Like, Barlow always told me, you know, nobody gives you your rights. You have to take them. That harkens back.
Them. They're like muscles, yes. Okay.
Yeah, and that harkens back to what Ben Franklin said after the Constitution was ratified, you know, and he was asked, you know, did we do a monarchy or a republic? And he said, well, a republic, if you can keep it. And I feel like we're in times right now where we're in the if you can keep it times. If we didn't all realize that before, I think people are increasingly realizing it now. And it's a participation time.
Thank you, Tangent. We appreciate the call. We got somebody else we want to make sure we get to before we run out of time here. We've got Marty on the line.
Hi. Yeah, I was just wondering if you would have any suggestions for people who are in professions that are required by law to offer confidentiality to their clients, such as people in medical professions or lawyers who have Gmail accounts and who conduct business on their Gmail accounts. And is there anything you might want to say about that, or is there anything that people should be concerned about that?
Well, I think there are two levels of concern. One is what Google knows about you based upon the scanning of your emails that they do, and the other is, you know, how available is that to law enforcement. I mean, I think it would be better to be on one that doesn't have that business model of scanning the content of your communications. I know that's not available to everyone, and so I don't want to give people advice that feels so hard. Gmail has other benefits. It's a pretty good spam filter and other kinds of things for users. But I think it is important to be mindful of it, and maybe, you know, take communications if they're getting, you know, with your clients, to, you know, take them to a more secure channel. Again, I like Signal, but even WhatsApp is end-to-end encrypted. Even Apple, if it's Apple-to-Apple device, is end-to-end encrypted, and they're testing and hopefully will soon roll out end-to-end encryption, you know, between Apple and Android and other devices. That's something that we are pushing them to do. But I think it's really, you're right to be mindful of that this business model. Now, you know, Google, to their credit, does a pretty good job of requiring a warrant or proper process. But on the national security side, you know, we know that there's more going on. And you know, the good news is that if you're using your browser, you know, the messages are encrypted between your browser and, or Mr. Snowden came out and demonstrated this. And so you have some protection, but I think it is right to be mindful of situations in which you might be putting the people you're caring for at risk by using a service that has, you know, this business model and this vulnerability.
Thanks for that insight. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, mm-hmm. Marty. We got just a couple of minutes left here. Cindy, before we have to let you go, we've talked a lot about what the sort of history of threats to privacy in the online space have been, some of which, you know, encryption, we got it, nice. And some of them we haven't gotten yet. What are some of the emerging threats that you're tracking right now?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I think people in Oregon are pretty active about is these automated license plate reader and other kinds of, we call it street level surveillance at EFF. This is the surveillance that is happening kind of in public to people. So things like doorbells and the network for Ring doorbells that is, you know, I think.
People got really freaked out by that Super Bowl
they
ad.
Did not like the
Wasn't
Super Bowl
that
ad.
Great? I mean, what a you know, this is so the kind of weird place of being a lawyer in the trenches like I am. I'm like, that's so great. Everybody's terrified. But the fact that people were able to see that and that reaction, like I saw that ad and I went, oh, my God, they're going to use that to pick up immigrants, right? They're going to use that to pick up people in our neighborhoods. And
really,
I thought,
they're not
going to
solve another 1,000 lost dog cases that have currently gone unsolved.
Even the We Lost, you know, the We Rate Dogs guy, who I adore, I'm a big dog person, you know, put out a little video saying that's not what they're going to use this for.
Right.
And there are other ways to find your dog. And here are the other ways to find your dog. But yeah, I think the fact that that had such a negative reaction, it was a big surprise to the companies involved, and had real consequences. They dropped a partnership they were thinking of doing with Flock, the license plate reader cameras. So, you know, again, that's horrible, but it's also good news in that it really demonstrated, I think, to these companies that people do have a line that they're drawing. And we're starting to see in Oregon and beyond people standing up and saying, we don't want these license plate readers in our communities. We don't know where that data is going. We can't trust the company that it's not going to places that is different than they're promising. So I think that that's an area where I always like to mention, because I think we're seeing some hope. And the nice thing is that, you know, sometimes you can feel very powerless in the federal fight. But hyperlocal, showing up at your local board of supervisors and your local representative, people can have a lot more power with a lot fewer people. So that's one. Of course, AI, and this introduction of these AI agents that see everything you do all day and then try to help you, you know, organize your day or make reservations or do things like that. Like, they don't have enough security on them yet. I want that world. I'm pro tech. But right now we are not living in a place where people can really trust that that's all the information is going to be used for, and it's going to stay local. And we need to build in, protections around that. And it's problematic. Those are two things that come to mind. And then there's this de-siloing, this idea that the government is taking information that's collected for one purpose and using it for another. That's one of the key privacy principles that goes all the way back to the 70s, that we need to reinstate.
Cindy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. We really appreciate it.
An enriching and
enlightening conversation.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be at Powell's tonight. It's one of my favorite bookstores. And my brother lives in Portland, so I get to see him too. So I'm very excited to come up this afternoon.
Book. It's a beautiful memoir, legal drama, call to arms. It's got everything in it.
I'm freaked out, but in a good way.
No pictures, though. So that's...
No, there's... But you got the... I like the picture of the AT&T... Ooh, okay.
I'm sorry. There are pictures in it.
I'll leave that for the
people. I've done a terrible job of pitching the book. It does have
pictures.
All
right. Thank you. All the proceeds go to EFF for the book. And so, you know, it's also another way that you can help support this work.
All right. We're going to leave it there. I'm Althea.
I'm Reed.
Thanks for listening to Genius Box. Thank you to Nate, our engineer. And we'll see you next time.
Hi, I'm Michael Van Cleek. I'm tapped into the vibe and the rhythm of the river of the city of Portland. And you are too, because you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Spring is in the air. The world is getting ready for its annual revival of itself. Embrace Mother Nature on that journey with the help of psychedelic rock.